So what I found is that a lot of people are familiar with some little part of AFI, but not AFI in terms of what they've done in the past and what we're doing now and all the different things that we do on a year-to-year basis. So I threw together a few slides for people to be able to go over this. This is just kind of a general primer. It was started in 1965 by the White House. It's a nonprofit that was intended to preserve the history of the American cinema culture and to honor the work of the filmmakers that's going on and to educate the next generation. So in order to do that, we did a few things. In 1969, the conservatory was created. That's the film school. A lot of people are mainly familiar with that. We have a number of programs that go along with that. Now, one of the ones we're very happy with right now is the Young Women in Film. It's high school students that come out in order to start learning about film and how to be able to make, how to become filmmakers. Some of the things that people are also familiar with might be our film festivals. We have AFI Fest that takes place in November every year. It's the last major film festival of the festival season. And shortly after AFI Fest, in January, we have AFI Awards, which is the first major awards show of the awards season. It takes place a day or two before the Golden Globes. Along the fest, we have DOCS, which is our documentary film festival. It takes place on the East Coast in Washington, D.C. every summer. So here in just a few weeks, we're going to have a bunch of people headed out that direction in order to do a lot of very politically motivated documentary work where you'll have lobbyists and whatnot come out and with Congress people come. And it's a very, very impactful film festival that's done a lot of great work over the years. And then along with the conservatory, we have the Harold Lloyd Master Seminar Series that takes place at the conservatory where some of the best filmmakers in the world come out and speak to the filmmakers that are in training, the fellows that are going through our MFA program, in order to be able to kind of glean the great gems of wisdom that they have. And this is really unique stuff that happens. I went to USC for film, and that was the best part about going to film school, was when Daniel Day-Lewis or Jim Sheridan would come out and speak about how they made a film. Because you hear things that you don't hear anywhere else in the world. It's very special. And one of the cool things that AFI has done is we've recorded them for 50 years. So now we've got a challenge of how do we take that 50 years worth of film and video and do something with it. And that's what we're going to be talking about a little bit today. So I mentioned the festivals. We have honorary degrees that are given out along with the Life Achievement Award. I'm sorry, the honorary degrees are given out at commencement by the conservatory. But the Life Achievement Award mentioned there in the bottom right, that's coming up in just a couple of weeks. Denzel Washington is our recipient this year. George Clooney was last year. Diane Keaton the year before that. And it's widely regarded as one of the highest achievements someone can achieve in the film industry. It's really pretty remarkable. It's quite a night. And it's one of our biggest fundraisers as a nonprofit. That's very important for us. And it raises a lot of money for the conservatory to be able to do scholarships for the fellows. So it's pretty important. The very first thing that AFI did was preservation. So we had 60,000 films, actual film prints that were rescued in the late 60s through the early 70s that were turned over to the Library of Congress to be able to prevent them from being literally just deteriorated and destroyed. And that's not the piece of work that AFI does anymore, but AFI kicked that work off, and now there are organizations all over the world, archives, that do that kind of preservation work to make sure that this stuff doesn't get lost. So now the Library of Congress has all of that. The other thing that started right off the bat was the Catalog of Feature Films, and that's where the EIGR work really comes in. The Catalog of Feature Films was called a catalog because it was initially an encyclopedic volume that was printed every 5 or 10 years, something like that. Thousands and thousands of pages of printed material that these days looks a lot like IMDb, is what most people are going to be familiar with. But AFI did this, capturing credit information, historic data, and synopses about all of these films that were literally disappearing. So AFI started that work off, and it was printed sometime in the 80s. It became a database, and we'll talk a little bit more about what that became. So I talked about the conservatory, the festivals, the awards. I think that covers most of the broad strokes in the catalog. So, and also the list. A lot of people remember the 100-100 lists and the TV shows that aired in the late 90s to the early 2000s, I want to say. I didn't know anything about those when I joined AFI. I just knew AFI as the other film school as I went to USC. And so a lot of people worldwide know about the AFI 100 list of the greatest films ranked 1 through 100, and they've done the greatest comedies and the greatest musical moments and whatnot. So that's one of the other things that AFI does that's really special, and those lists are all available on our website. So, catalog. That's what really drove the EIDR integration. Catalog, like I mentioned, was built in the early 60s and late in the 70s as a printed volume. In the 80s, it became a database of some sort. I think it was a star or something or other. In the early 2000s, it became a SQL database, and then it kind of sat. The data got updated quite a lot. Then we have a team that's working on it all the time, doing all this important research, and I'll show you the results of that. But what we needed to do was update it. It had to get modernized. We had to be able to use this data and make it available to more people. So we put it in the cloud, and we did a lot of interesting things with it. Are you? Do you have a? You seem like you're about to ask something.
I thought we memorized your slides, so I don't know exactly where we get to this point. But the catalog is not just an academic resource.
Correct.
It is a practical, useful tool available to people if they can get access to it. So, what are, if we can jump ahead, what are sort of the commercial endpoints and commercial uses of the AFI catalog?
So far, what we've done with it is it's been available, you mentioned academic resource. What the catalog has been primarily is an academic tool for researchers and historians to be able to pull information that they can't find anywhere else. It's widely regarded as the best data source of its kind. And I'll show you what it has in 1 second. But also, commercial entities have come along and licensed that content for us. Turner Classic Movies, their website is powered primarily by the data that's in the AFI catalog. So when you go see a film on Turner Classic, let's say you're going to watch To Kill a Mockingbird, and you go to their website and you're seeing all the information about Gregory Peck and everybody that was in it and worked on it and all this information, that's all AFI catalog data. Here's a little sample. Excuse me. When we rebuilt it, we put it into the Azure cloud, built it very much driven by APIs so that that data could be accessible by third parties. But what we'll talk about in a second is how do we get people to be able to access it? Because when we've done our ProQuest and our Turner Classic Movies data dumps, those have been old school, sneaker net kind of deliver a big chunk of data and send it to them. Maybe it gets FTP'd or whatever, but it's a very manual process. So what we wanted to do is to get this stuff ready for the next 50 years is how do we make it more widely available and automatically available. So this is what the catalog of feature films looks like. This is one of our premiere records. So on the front page there, that carousel where we have a few posters of things, those are what we call premiere films, where we've gone in and we've said, okay, these are some of the movies that have been on those AFI 100 lists. They're movies where we have content of filmmakers coming and speaking about the film. So we have additional content and we can source some posters. So we call it a premiere record. And then below you have all the different stuff that makes up that record. This tab that's highlighted at the bottom on the left is history. This is production history. This is first, Sarah Clavier, who manages the catalog, always knows this terminology better than I do. But it's first source or original source citation. Primary source, that's it. Primary source citation, I can never remember that. Primary source, meaning the research that they're doing is from the trades, from the LA Times, from the New York Times, at the time that the film was made. So when they pulled this data about Citizen Kane, they went back to the records from 1939, 40, 41, 42, when the film was actually happening, and pulling that information and loading it up. So you see Mercury Theater is proud to introduce, blah, 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 organized by Orson Welles. All that information will come directly from the trades. It's not AFI saying this is what happened. It's AFI saying the New York Times, the LA Times, at the time of production, made this stuff happen. This is, in my view, this is the real gem of the catalog, because this is information that's not available anywhere else in the world. You've got to go really, really dig for this and know what you're trying to find in order to get it.
And I'm going to take a quick ticket, I
please know.
nobody likes to admit that they use IMDb for commercial purposes. But we regularly see studios provide information about their works out into the world and then buy it back from other providers. And so the studios are regularly buying back IMDb data on their own films and competitive films. But the problem with IMDb data is that it's largely crowdsourced. We don't really know the quality or the provenance of that data. Can you rely on it? Is it complete? Is it accurate? And at EIDR, we are largely agnostic. We will connect to any data source, because our focus is all about making those connections, driving you to IMDb if you want IMDb, driving you to British Film Institute if you want their take on something, driving you to Flickster, Netflix, Amazon, etc. But also to trusted data sources, to places you can go. And so we already have, I'm going to say, easily tens of thousands of AFI IDs already registered, and we're looking to do the entire catalog. But we're particularly excited about just the quality and breadth of the data that's now available. And using the cross-links in the EIDR registry can be linked to other data sets.
Right.
And we're hoping there'll be sort of a symbiotic cross-link there, where AFI will drive linkage into the IRIS set that will drive linkage out to other things back in through again.
Exactly, and that's exactly what I've been hoping for the entire time. I really got behind the idea of IDER when we were doing this rebuild onto this platform, so that we would have the ability to license the content out more automatically. Say you've got an over-the-top provider that needs to be able to backfill. They've got all their shows that they've licensed, but they don't have any metadata about the shows. Where can they pull that? Data sources like this are one way to be able to do that. And so when we rebuilt the database, we wanted to make sure that it was able to handle that and accommodate it. So the catalog database also has the next tab over is details. These are production notes about, like, what is it? Was it shot on anamorphic? What lenses was it used, et cetera? How long is the movie? Credits, this is what you're going to be most familiar with as far as, like, IMDb-type data, et cetera. But this is all data that came directly from the screen. This isn't sourced from some other location. Actual qualified researchers went in, viewed the film, pulled the credit data directly from the screen as it was viewed. Back in the day, they'd go to a theater and do a special screening at Warner Brothers or wherever they did it. Nowadays, it's been a lot of VHS, DVD, Blu-ray in order to get this information. But it's all pulled, and it's extremely accurate. It's widely regarded as the best data source of its kind in the world. The synopsis, same thing. The film was viewed by someone who then took copious notes, and this is a document of the film. It's not an award-winning film with a striking performance by Meryl Streep. It's the sun rose, the father died, she cried, the dog reflects, dog represents whatever it represents, because that's what's set up in the film itself. It's a document of the film object. It's not critical analysis or anything like that.
We have more time.
It was a thumbs up at the end.
He was just waving.
Say hello. Think about the phone.
The other thing that's interesting about the data source that's here that I really love is these genre categories. So you got the genre, you know, comedy, subgenre, gangster, or whatever. But all these subject matters, these are all Library of Congress subject matters. So every piece of data that's in the AFI catalog is tied to something else. It's authoritative based on other information sources. It's not AFI sentence. It's AFI is validating what has been said. And I think that's really the important.
That's that taxonomy from Library of Congress, which is credibility from the get-go.
So that's mainly what I wanted to show you about the catalog, just to kind of to display what the data source is. We're redoing our entire public-facing web presence right now. This is a little sneak peek of what that new catalog page may look like when we're done with it. It's one of the comps that we're working on. I figured I'd give you a little teaser about that. One of the things you asked about, Richard, was commercial ties.
Yes,
and that's driven very much by the ability to have linked data. IDER, for us, represents a controlled data set. We have about 60,000 film records in our database, and IDER has all of these very unique identifiers of what that film is. You'll probably be able to talk about this better than I can. You've got the abstraction of the concept of The Godfather, and then you've got the American cinema release of The Godfather, and then the American video edit or the TV edit.
Yeah, it's all linked in a tree. So you've got the work in the abstract, but all the creative cuts or versions that all have their own IDs, and underneath those, all the different encodings, transcodings, representations can have their own IDs. So you get as detailed as you need to be, or be as generic as you need to be. Many people just use the abstraction ID and say, well, I just need to talk about The Godfather. That's all I need. I can link everything I need off of that. Others say, no, I need to know which cut of The Godfather.
Or language translation.
Subs and dubs, all those fun things. So it depends on your workflow which ID you need, but they're all available and they're all cross-linked. One piece of random trivia I have, don't know why, but the record with the most alternate IDs is the Polar Express. Don't know why, but we have 60 other sources that are linked to that IRA record. So from the Movie Labs did a demonstration where they built a system that would start with an IRA ID. It would go to the IDER record, pull all the alt IDs. We provide the code to transform those IDs into URLs. So we provide that for you. Go to those sites, grab that data. So from an IDER ID, they came back with all of the release territories, all the release titles for the film, box office performance, full cast, full crew, and piracy rates, one sheets, genres, all this wealth of linked material that was brought together, starting from that lowly little IDER ID. And now, AFI catalog, which was terrible to
me. Me too. I'm really thrilled that we're going to be able to tie all this together. One of the things that I find exciting about what IDER does is that ability to link the abstraction of the film, which is what most of our catalog data represents. But then you noticed in the details page, it showed, 35mm print this long, released on such and such day. That's the American theatrical release, which is going to be a sub-IDER ID of that initial abstraction. It's an edit, yeah. So we can now, through the rebuild of the database, we can tie those IDER IDs to the different pieces of the database as well. That idea about 60,000 movies is a big deal, but it's also a relatively controlled data set that also has a very well-defined workflow to be able to make those IDs work, which is what the IDER team has done. The interesting thing is, what can we do with that concept of taking those data sources and validating them and apply it to other sorts of data? And one of the projects that AFI has coming up now that we've just embarked upon is the brainchild of my colleague Sarah Clothier, who's actually speaking about the same stuff in Amsterdam right now, maybe tomorrow, a project called Women They Talk About. And this is about gender parity across the history of the film business, because the film business is one of the only employment records of who has worked on what that goes back a long time. You can't find out Google's employment records, but you can find out the movie business's employment records, because it's all documented. And AFI has that data going back to the very beginning, the first 100 years of American cinema, 1893 to 1993. And it turns out, we believe, it turns out that women had parity within the film business in the early days, in the silent film era, basically possibly until around the time the studios came along. So what we're doing now is a lot of research to be able to prove this. And the National Endowment for the Humanities agreed with this research and gave us a really wonderful grant to be able to empower Sarah and her team to be able to do this, partnering with the Gina Davis Institute, and I believe USC Annenberg School is involved somehow. I'm not sure about the details. We also got a wonderful grant from the Lovell Foundation to fund the technology aspect of this. But what we're doing is we're taking these credits, all the film on-screen and off-screen credits, as well as the, in front of the camera, behind the camera, as well as off-screen credits that are accomplished and found through that research that they do in the primary source citations, in order to find out who worked on this stuff. Because a lot of times, a man got credit, but a woman actually did the work. You know, it's like the theory about Shakespeare's work. Maybe it was his wife, right? So that actually happened quite a bit. And so now what we're going to be able to do is take the credit data that we have, run it against these gender APIs using the same type of data that IDER uses, because it's all API driven. With the new catalog database, we can take that information, drive it against the APIs, analyze the names based on the time period, based on the geographic location that they were from, and based on the name, and we can get back information about whether or not that's a likely male or female name, to where we can start to do really deep analysis of gender parity across the industry, going back to the early 1910s, 1900s, 1920s, and then we're also going to do a lot of research to validate that information in the early days. But that information is also, the analysis will be applied across the history of the entire catalog data set that goes all the way through 1993. And we're really excited about what that's going to do. The gender API work is also a fairly controlled data set, because you have, for the most part, two variables, right? Male, female. Nowadays you have some other possibilities that we're going to talk about in a second as well. But there's also, that then leads the way to, how do we figure out if people's names are accurate? Because you've got 23 different John Smiths. That introduces a whole new problem. Thank you. That introduces a whole new problem. I want to go through a couple more slides really quickly. This is about the Women They Talk About project. We'll get a nice new skin in the catalog where it will prompt a lot of interesting questions that people will be able to deep dive into the data to research and ask their own questions, and display graphical results of what kind of work was done through that. So there, in 2017, there was some interesting work that was done around data visualization. We're exploring that, and we're very excited about the possibilities. And some of the challenges that go along with this, So gender designation, male, female, we're going to use APIs to be able to do that. The ethics around that. So you've got male, female, but what about people that don't identify as either? How do we identify that? And what do you do about the fact that there's a time that goes along with when someone transitioned, for example? So the database is built to be able to accommodate that as well. Objective data, one of the questions Richard asked was about having a really clear data source and a trusted data source. So our team, Sarah's team, is doing a lot of work around when they go and do this research, how are they sourcing the validity of that when they've got a name that's only partially matched?
Right, it's, AFI is already a trusted data source, and as you're bringing out all this information, you want to remain a trusted data source.
Exactly.
You don't want to be polluting and diminishing your own data set just for this purpose.
That's right. So that's one of the issues that the team's going to be working on. And then I mentioned the name disambiguation, where we're trying to figure out, is it this John Smith or that John Smith or that Betty White or whatever? You know, there are two John, there are two Harrison Fords. There was a big movie star back in, I believe, the 30s that was also named Harrison Ford. And I didn't know that, but it's one of the popular memes in the catalog team because they've got a picture of Harrison Ford and then the other Harrison Ford. And you're like, these are not the same Harrison Ford. But it's easy to get that mixed up. I was employee number 11 at the studio system back in the late 90s, and this name disambiguation problem existed even then. And that was in the days before you had proper name identifiers. And that's one of the things that you guys are starting to...
At various previous incarnations of this, it's been talked about. Eric Erickson, I think, is here today. I saw him earlier today, so he's been talking about person identification, which is sort of the next great evolution of identification, is not just keeping all of the works straight with all the people.
Right. Parties involved with the project.
So I think we're getting close on time. How are we on your slides?
I think this is the last. These are just additional detailed slides about that stuff. So we've done a pilot study of the gender API data that comes back. It turns out we're getting upwards of 8% of the names end up with a 96% accuracy rating. The results that we're getting back from the initial API runs on the gender identity are much better than we actually anticipated. So I think the results of this over the next couple of years will be very, very positive.
So let me ask this also, because I think we're getting over time here, but can folks get a copy of this deck if they come up and talk to you afterwards?
Absolutely. I think it's going to be sent out by the Mesa folks. You can get the entire data set, and my contact information is at the end, as well as Sarah Clovier and Catalog. And we're happy to talk to anybody about all this.
So two quick things. One is another plug for LinkedIn, that this becomes a new data set. This becomes more information available to the industry, accessible via the API catalogs, accessible via the API ID, available in the IRA registry, and therefore accessible to the rest of the world via that as well, sort of making it all one happy data family, bringing it all together.
Exactly.
And then on a personal note, like you'll notice I'm wearing my black Hawaiian shirt today, in mourning for the end of Game of Thrones. But this actually is a pretty good one for high fantasy and sword and sorcery, because it also is the premiere of the Tolkien Bible. And I just saw the latest Downton Abbey trailer, which was magical! But it's probably not considered high fantasy.
Probably not.
But we're all about film and enjoying the industry that we're working in, randomly, what is your favorite high fantasy or sword and sorcery?
So I think, speaking as the official AFI voice in the room, I believe the highest ranked sword and sorcery movie on the AFI lists is The Fellowship of the Ring.
Okay.
My personal favorite, I think, is Two Towers. But if I go back and explore my inner, like, middle schooler, I gotta say I have a fond spot in my heart for Lady Hawk, which isn't on any lists anywhere. I don't know if it's a good movie or not anymore, but I
saw one more back for Lady Hawk. Okay. Thank you, Scott. Thank you, Richard. Thank you. And thank you, everyone, for joining us today.
Thanks, everyone.
Appreciate it.